From a secret location in room 100 of 540 Jack Gibbs Boulevard, this is Craft. I'm your host, Doug Dangler. Matt Kish is a featured author at this year's Ohioana Book Festival on May 10th. He's the illustrator of Moby Dick in Pictures, one picture for every page, and most recently, a similar strategy for Heart of Darkness. Welcome to Craft, Matt Kish.
Hello.
You are going to be at the May 10th Ohioana Festival this year as a featured author. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And you have a couple of books that I think you'll be offering for sale there. You'll be talking about them. One of them is your 2011 Moby Dick in Pictures, one picture for every page. And that is based on your favorite book when you were a kid, Moby Dick. Is that right?
Yeah, actually, it's sort of the culmination of a lifelong and ongoing obsession with Herman Melville and Moby Dick.
Okay. How did that obsession come about? That's maybe for a young person a little bit of a surprising obsession.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of strange. It's a long story, so I'll try to do my best to make this succinct. When I was a very young person, like many young boys, I was obsessed with monster movies and comic books and video games and real fantastic kinds of entertainment like that. And I used to go to my grandmother's house on Saturday afternoons while my father ran errands. And on WUAB 43, I used to watch the Superhost monster movie marathon. One particular afternoon, my father was a bit late picking me up from my grandmother's, and the Japanese monster movies had ended, but the 1950s film Moby Dick had begun. The one with Gregory Peck as Captain Ahab. And, you know, I was initially very bored because there were just these men in funny costumes and ships with sails. And I could tell that this was history, which I associated with school, which was not a positive for me. Right. But within a very short amount of time, the screen became filled with these images of the white whale, which to me was a fascinating thing to see because this was a monster, truly a fantastic, monstrous thing, but it was existing within the confines of this relatively realistic story. And so it was almost as if these two worlds came together. And so I always like to point that out as my first experience with Moby Dick, because it highlights that for me, you know, my first taste of the story was a visual one. And my father had come back by the time I was getting really into the movie. And he watched it with me and explained, I was probably 8 years old at the time, he said, you know, this movie is based on a book. And he bought me this abridged version of it, which also was loaded with illustrations. And, you know, that's where the story of Maya began. It was that first childhood taste of this fantastic tale that, you know, that seemed like something that could have actually happened in the world that I lived in.
But you didn't live near the ocean or anything like that. You've lived in the Midwest your whole life.
It's kind of a funny aspect of it because, you know, we had gone to Florida many times because my grandparents lived there. You know, so it's not as if the ocean was completely foreign to me, but, you know, the world of New England whaling was definitely a very, very alien concept. Mm-hmm. You know, other than those occasional summer trips to Florida and the Atlantic Ocean, yeah, the ocean was really never a part of my life. I've been very, very landlocked. So this entire narrative of Moby Dick, you know, it has always taken place for me really within the realm of my own imagination.
Tell me about your decision to do one picture for every page of Moby Dick.
I began in August of 2009, and that was a strange summer for me. I had just turned 40 years old in June of 2009. And, you know, that's an arbitrary boundary, but it is a boundary. It's a good point to assess where you've been and where you hope to go. Now, I had been drawing all of my life, but I am a self-taught artist. You know, the last art class that I had taken was as a freshman in community college. So, you know, I don't have the BFA or the MFA. Art for me has always been something that I've pursued in a very private fashion and for very personal reasons. But by the time I turned 40, I had grown a little bit frustrated with making art. I was finally involved in a career that I was very passionate about as a public librarian. I had been married for a number of years, and there were all these other things that were enriching my life. So when I turned 40 years old, I thought perhaps this is time for me to stop making art, you know, to set the pens down and to move on to other pursuits. But something just wouldn't let me do that. I think perhaps there was a bit of fear, you know, that this thing which had been a part of my life for so long, what would I do to fill the absence that it left? And part of it was just a reluctance. You know, I remembered all of the good and fulfilling experiences that I had had as a self-taught artist. And so I decided, and my wife will attest to this tendency to be very rash, but I decided really in an instant that if I was indeed going to stop making art, that I wanted to go out on top and essentially pursue what for me was the dream project, the thing that I had always wanted to see, but, you know, never really had the courage to attempt. And, you know, I was familiar with a few other artists who had done the sort of, you know, one illustration per page. Zach Smith in particular is one of them. His work was a huge inspiration. And so I thought, you know, if this is it, if this is the end, I'm going to do the illustrated version of Moby Dick that I have always seen in my mind. You know, the images that I've imagined every time that I've read this book, I'm going to make these real. And then I'm either going to quit while I'm on top, or perhaps I will have discovered in a new way what art means to me as an adult moving forward through life. And so it really came to me very quickly. And it was really just an attempt to do that dream project, that holy grail, that thing that I always wanted to see, but perhaps was too reluctant to try.
How often during the project did you start wondering, is this your great white whale, right? I mean, it seems like you've got this great parallel where you're working at something, and the way you've set it up in your mind, you've got a lot to work against, sort of. You got a lot to motivate you, but at the same time, if this is going to be your last project, I can see a reluctance to finishing it. You know, I can see you like, well, I'll be Ahab and I'll just not finish, and or you know, somehow be tied to your book as it sinks or something like that. I mean, it's a very unusual book to tie yourself to in that way, because there's so many immediate parallels that one might think about the subject matter of the book and what you're attempting to do.
Mm-hmm. Those parallels actually are really very, very accurate. I mean, that may sound slightly cliche to admit to, but it's very much the truth. They really made themselves known to me very early on. It's a strange progression for me. I began enjoying the project almost immediately. And so I think that from very early on in the project, even though I was working, you know, every single day and kind of depriving myself of having a real life, because everything in my life now, you know, was revolving around the completion of this task. So I gave up a lot, but I felt really intensely fulfilled by the work. And so I felt very early on that I was going to continue making art. I knew almost immediately that this was not going to be the last thing I did. So what you mentioned earlier about sort of a reluctance to finish, that didn't cross my mind. And in fact, it was the opposite. As the project wound on, day after day, week after week, month after month, you know, through the seasons, passing the 1 year mark, because the entire project took me about 18 months to complete. My obsession with finishing grew. That became the white whale, this intense desire to be done with it, because I felt I was losing more and more with every single day. And I knew that the only path out of this, in a sense, this is sort of a parallel to Ahab. You know, there were only two ways out of it. One was to complete the work, you know, to kill the white whale, or to kill myself. And I certainly wasn't going to do that. You know, I had made this very solemn promise to myself that I was going to complete this work. There was no way that I was going to go back or take a break or put it on hold for any reason. I had to finish. So very slowly, over the course of that amount of time that it took me to finish, I absolutely became driven by my obsession to finish all 552 illustrations. And that obsession is what propelled me forward, but it really did come at quite a personal cost. You know, when I've had the opportunity to talk about my book at various places, you know, people often ask me two questions. They'll say, do you have any regrets? And I'll say to them that I don't. I don't regret what I did. I'm immensely proud of it. But then they often follow that up with asking me, would I do it again? And I say, absolutely not. I would never engage in a task that ludicrously ambitious, that harrowing, and that at times corrosive, as I did. I would never go down that path again.
Is there some irony when you say that the next project you chose was Heart of Darkness, which seems to me like there's a theme here in the works that you're choosing to illustrate. You've got another obsessive quest, right? In
Yes,
Heart of
yes.
Darkness there. So what drew you to Heart of Darkness? He says, thinking he may already know.
It is absolutely the theme of obsession, as well as the ideas present in both texts. I mean, both of those are novels that I came across relatively early in life. I had read each multiple times, and both are responsible for really shaping the person that I become and the way I view the world that I live in. They're really a big part of my identity and my worldview. And so it was an enormous privilege to have the opportunity to illustrate both of those in such a public way. But the darkness of the texts and the nihilism and the bleakness and the obsession and just that sense of loss and darkness in both of them, that isn't something that is I'm very, very aware of it. I guess that's a good way to put it. And sort of the running joke in my house with between my wife and I is that if I have a chance to illustrate and publish a third book, that it should definitely be something like The Wizard of Oz, because at this point I've plumbed the depths of human misery and despair so deeply that there's no more to be gained from thrusting myself back into that.
Well, we'll look forward to The Wizard of Oz. One, one, just for your own sanity, I think, is what we're
Right.
going to be. One question I was curious about in the illustrations for Moby Dick, you're doing a lot of found paper.
Right.
The first time I looked at them, I happened to look at them online. There was a sample on Amazon, and I thought, well, somebody at Amazon made a mistake. Because what's going on here? And it took me a while before I started being, I zoomed in on the caption. I said, oh, okay, on found paper. Tell me about the choice you made with found paper.
There were actually two reasons for the found paper. One of them was for purely aesthetic reasons, which I'll talk about first. And the second reason is more process driven. The aesthetic reasons are that prior to this project, my drawings and my art had been really intensely and laboriously detailed, almost to the point where the act of drawing itself had become physically unpleasant, and that physical barrier became a mental barrier for me. And I could say, and this kind of goes along with me getting to the point where I felt like perhaps it's time for me to give up making art, because it was physically difficult to continue drawing these lavishly detailed illustrations. And that got in the way of me actually wanting to do it as well. And when you stop wanting to do something, it becomes very easy to come up with excuses not to do it. So, I had experimented very briefly with found paper on a few little projects prior to this Moby Dick work. And what I liked about that aesthetically was that in trying to make my marks on a piece of paper that already had something on it, whether it was words, or whether they were diagrams or charts, visual information, what I was able to do was sort of let go of that obsession with controlling every aspect of the image. So when you're looking at a blank piece of white paper, you have this sense of responsibility, this feeling of everything that exists on that paper you're going to put down there, and so you've really got to do this incredible job. And so for me, that became a real barrier. But in learning to sort of let that go, let that obsessiveness grow, let that absolute obsessiveness with control, letting that go, working on found paper really freed me up to see the process of making art in completely different ways. So rather than struggling against the paper, rather than working in ways which were physically uncomfortable, I now felt a new kind of freedom. As strange as that may seem, I felt a kind of freedom in sort of embracing the random, the elements of chance,
Right.
seeing what would show through, what would be obscured, what juxtapositions might exist between the marks that I was making and the information that already existed on the page. So in a sense, it was an act of creative destruction for me. It was really sort of blowing up the way that I was making art prior to this and learning completely new ways of making images. That's the aesthetic reason why I chose the found paper. But Immediately after completing that first illustration, I realized that subconsciously I had made really what would be the only proper choice for what this project meant to me and how I wanted to conceptualize these illustrations. What I was hoping to do by using found paper was visually parallel, the structure and the themes of the novel. So one can read Moby Dick and really just look at the surface of the narrative, this tale of Captain Ahab's mad obsession with the whale that has maimed him and his desire to destroy it. And if one chooses to read no more deeply than that, you've still read a rollicking good adventure tale full of high spirits and high seas and all sorts of amazing things. But if one chooses to reread and then reread and continue to explore the deeper levels of the novel, there are all sorts of ideas, meanings, hidden elements. There is so much more to Moby Dick than what is just on the surface of the narrative. There are all of these elements to the narrative, all of these elements to the story, which only become apparent, I think, to the careful reader, the one willing to spend time with the story, the one the person who's willing to really closely examine Melville's words. And so what I had hoped to do with these illustrations, which, as you mentioned, were primarily on TV repair guides, electronics repair diagrams, generally I was attracted with the found paper to the visual representation of information, charts, diagrams, lists, things of that sort. To the viewer looking at my illustrations, what I hoped they would see was that same sort of structure paralleled in a visual sense. You would see my illustrations showing the action of the novel laid over the top of this, these found pages. But if you chose to spend more time looking very closely at the found paper and at the way certain words, certain bits of information, diagrams, and certain visual elements would sometimes show through, sometimes be obscured, sometimes again end up in these very strange, almost random juxtapositions, but which could then stimulate the viewer into viewing both my image and the story in new ways and in unexpected ways. I thought that I would be able to parallel what Melville was doing with his words. And I think I was actually a lot more successful than I realized. There are certain illustrations where there are almost eerie echoes of what Melville was doing. And that, again, is the strange confluence of my art, the found paper, and his words. There's one in particular. I wish I could remember the exact page number, and I apologize. It's an image of Fleece, who is the old, very, very old chef on board the Pequod. And so I've done an illustration of him, and I did it on a page from a pictures book, a children's picture book about time. And Fleece is He's gesturing. One of his hands is very lively and it's moving and it's gesturing in the image. And that hand is actually over a bit of text from the children's picture book that says last year. His other hand is hanging limply and dead at his side. And that is over a bit of text that says next year. And I think what's so interesting about that is that within the confines of the novel, last year, Fleece, as well as everyone else on the Pequod, was alive, was moving, was lively. Next year, of course, they will all be dead, rotting at the bottom of the sea. So it's just these subtle visual parallels that I think provide an entirely different way of looking at the story itself.
Well, that is great. And you will have the book at Ohio, Anna, to show
Yes.
people and to let them purchase it, as well as your 2013 Heart of Darkness illustrations. Matt Kish, I thank you very much for talking to me today on Craft. We can look forward to seeing you at Ohio Anna as a featured author.
Thank you very much. I'm very excited to be there, and it's an extraordinary honor for me who, I was born in Ohio and I've lived all my life here. I'm very proud of being from Ohio, so being able to take part in this festival is just a really deeply humbling honor. I'm very excited about it.
Have a great day.
Thank you.
For more information from my guests, visit www.craftheshow.com. This is Doug Dangler. Until next time, be creative.